Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Dunley, looking for Andrea. But while we wait for Andrea, we start off with the discussion of the proposal to put a garbage transfer station in the south end of Albany, which is designated as an environmental justice community. Then John Amidon joins us to discuss the Earth Day protest about the military and climate taking place at the Hancock Air Force Base out in Syracuse. Then Ramblin' Labor correspondent Willie Terry, second part of his interview about organizing Black workers in the South, including with Amazon. Then we hear from Heather Briegel about bringing an indigenous perspective to the upcoming Sustainable Futures Conference. And for dessert, we talk about Landsberg Snowman, which has been open since the 1950s. But first, some headlines. The Time Union reports that a boom lift crashed into a Northway overpass early Wednesday morning, damaging the support girder above and leaving the southbound side of the highway closed for many hours so repairs could be made.
Sita Basilia Hickey.
The only two Democrats on the ballot for mayor of the city of Albany in the June 22nd Democratic Party primary will be Mayor Kathy Sheehan and Reverend Valerie Faust. Faust's campaign successfully challenged the petitions of activists Marlon Anderson and Lukey Forbes. Also running in a primary for a seat in the Albany County Legislature is former legislator Brian Scavo, who was convicted in 2015 of two counts of criminal possession of a Ford instrument. The TU reports that 4 months after Schenectady City police officers launched an extensive outreach campaign, which included trudging through thigh-deep snow for welfare checks, they have relocated an encampment of people living on the edge of Vale Park that had caused concern in the neighborhood. Social service agencies which assisted in the effort, including finding housing and other services for the individuals, include the Schenectady County Office of Community Services, Catholic Charities, City Mission, and New Choices. The Gazette reports on Tuesday night, protesters marched to the Schenectady Police Department to protest the killing of Dante Wright, a Black man fatally shot by a white police officer during a traffic stop in a Minneapolis suburb Sunday. The officer is to be charged with second-degree manslaughter for killing the 20-year-old. New York schools are now operating under the most recent federal public health guidelines for K-12 schools, potentially opening the door to more in-person instruction. The Gazette noted that the new distancing guidelines allow schools to separate students in classrooms by 3 feet, down from the initial 6 feet. But the lower distancing requirements are not suggested for middle and high schools in counties with a high transmission risk. The risk of virus transmission is lower among younger students and increases with age. President Biden announced on Wednesday that he intends to withdraw all remaining American troops from Afghanistan by the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. There are still 2,500 American troops in the country, down from a high of 100,000 in 2011. Republicans, as well as some Democrats in Congress, expressed their opposition to ending the longest American war, contending it was premature. Finally, the governor has announced that the 11 p.m. curfew for bars and restaurants will be extended to midnight, starting on April 19th. The close-in for catered events will be 1 a.m. That's it for headlines.
And first up, Mark talks with Albany activist Dominic Casolaro about a proposal by Waste Management to begin to accept municipal garbage at their transfer station in the south end of Albany.
We're joined today by Dominic Casolaro, who is a resident of the South End of Albany and a former city council member in the South End. Dominic's been raising some concerns about a new proposal by Waste Management to put another or a new transfer station for garbage down in the South End. It's something actually had been defeated, rejected back in 2009. So Dominic, can you maybe walk us through this new proposal and what some of the concerns are?
Sure. Waste Management already has a transfer facility there, but it's only for C&D construction and demolition debris and dry materials. So they want to expand it to take in household waste, municipal solid waste, MSW, which is putrescible waste. It's very smelly. So they're proposing to amend their solid waste permit from DEC to enable them to bring in MSW to the facility. And they did try this, I just mentioned, 2009, pretty much as the same proposal. We had to come together and got DEC to deny the permit amendment. And hopefully we can do the same thing again this year.
What are some of the concerns around the transfer station?
Well, the concerns with municipal solid waste, putrescible waste is, you're talking organics, food scraps, you're talking, diapers. It's waste that's going to come from 8 counties outside of Albany. That's going to be brought into Albany, into the Port of Albany, to the transfer station. Waste Management has landfills in other places. I don't know why they can't do it at one of their own landfills. I'd love to see them build it up in Saratoga, since they took over the Saratoga landfill, So you have that. You have the possibility of vectors of odors. In the proposal, they can keep the putrescible waste on site for 7 days before it has to be moved. They're going to keep it on trailers on site. There's only one major drain in the facility, so the leakage, the leachate from the garbage is going to go into one drain and go into the Albany County sewer system. And go through the sewer treatment plant in the South End. And it's already an environmental injustice community there. It's located, another quarter of a mile from Ezra Prentice Homes, from people on South Pearl Street, from Giffen Elementary School. And we're already overburdened with, 1,600 diesel trucks a day with the Port of Albany and all these other industries, scrap metal, recycling centers already. It's just, to me, again, it's a burden on a poor community and a community mostly of residents of color.
Now, I know in the past that South End residents have raised concerns about the diesel emission and its impact upon air quality, but it doesn't seem like the state takes it seriously. I think I saw a report maybe a year or 2 years ago that said, you got some health problems out there, but it's more lifestyle choices, People don't eat right, drink, all those type of issues rather than the diesel emissions. Is there any positive response from city or state officials at this point to the diesel emission issues down there?
Well, I know DEC last year contacted me. They wanted to do a follow-up to the air quality study, which wasn't part of the original proposed study that they did a couple of years ago. But they were going to take it upon themselves to do a follow-up and see if having diverted some of the truck traffic from South Pearl Street to go into the port, either from the South Port entrance or going from Madison Avenue, right off 787. But they've gotten some of the companies to divert the traffic to see if that had made a difference in the air quality down there. But because of COVID, they had to put that follow-up study off. So I'm hoping they can do it again this summer. But, in the city, the Mayor Sheen does have with the city trucks, use Corning Hill and avoid going through the Ezra Prentice to South Pearl Street, to the heart of Ezra Prentice Homes. Port has asked some of their customers to do the same thing. But again, 1,600 trucks a day, it's not, I don't know how many are really being diverted. So we need another study, that's air quality, but a truck traffic study again. And the waste management study, they get about 165 trucks a day alone, just waste management alone. Huge garbage, bringing in the debris.
Their prior proposal to do a garbage transfer station there in 2009 was rejected. Why was it rejected back in 2009, and have those reasons changed?
I'm trying to recall. I believe a lot of it had to do with odor and leachate control. So what they're going to do for the odor, which is really, to me, it's hilarious, in the proposal, they're going to put automatic doors on the transfer facility. So they'll open up automatically, the truck will go in, and it'll close behind the truck. And then when the truck leaves, it'll open up again to leave and come back down. So that's the odor control. They're not putting in any deodorizer, any cleaning. And in fact, even in the proposal, they said other waste management facilities have these odor controls, but they are not going to put them in unless down the road, if the automatic doors aren't doing the job on the odor control, then they'll put the system. So again, it's a state, you know, again, we're being slapped in the face here in the South End. Other waste management facilities have this, and they won't even go that far to put in an odor control system in, just automatic doors. And I try to figure it out. 165 trucks a day. They're open from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m., but they only take in trucks to 5 p.m. So that's somewhere around, you know, 6 to 5. You know, it's 11 hours, 165 trucks. You know, you're talking, you know, 12, 13, 14 trucks an hour. So that's every 30 seconds, just about. That door is, what's it going to do? Go up and down, up and down, up and down? You know, how is that going to control odors? So again, you know, they're just stepping on the people of the South End, people of color and low-income people. You know, it's, to me, it's such an insult. The more I read the proposal, the more upset I get. You know, these proposals are hundreds of pages long, so it's very hard to, to get through everything. But it's just such an insult to us.
So how can people in the South End and elsewhere, you know, have any input into this process? What's sort of the public hearing procedure? Well, and who actually is making the decision on this?
Well, DEC will have to make the decision, but waste management is required because it's an environmental justice community to hold a public meeting first. So the public meeting is scheduled for, they have two scheduled for April 29th, one at 10 a.m. and one at 7 p.m. It's the same information at both. You have to go to this website, wm.com/Albany-transfer-station to register. And you can register for one or the other or for both. And then they'll send you a Zoom link because it's going to be an online meeting. The other thing you can do is you can send written comments either to the transfer station people or to DEC. So if you go to that website, again, wm.com/Albany-transfer-station, there's in links that give you the addresses to DEC or to Waste Management for written comments. But this has been in the works since 2020. They first proposed this. They started working on this more than a year ago in early 2020. And now we're just finding out about it now, which is, again, you know, the community is not being involved and they're required to hold this public hearing because of an environmental justice community.
You know, you mentioned possibly going up to the Saratoga landfill, which I assume they're going to argue is more costly, of course, the transportation distances.
Right. That's the big excuse. You're right, Mark. That's the biggest reason for using this transfer station for MSW is the transportation savings.
So are there other alternatives that should be considered, do you think, of?
Well, I think what they're already doing already. They have local landfills. They just want to bring the garbage trucks down to this port, dump everything onto a cement floor, and then it gets bulldozed into the bigger tractor trailers that ship the garbage out. It's going to save them, $79,000 or $80,000 a year or some number. But they already have all the local landfills, and it's eight other counties. It's eight counties outside of the city of Albany. So why can't they find a place in a nice rural area? Not around the community of color, not around a community of low income to medium income people, and build a brand new facility up to the date facility to handle all this, that it will have odor controls and leachate controls. They got the money. I mean, Waste Management, you know, it's a multi-billion-dollar a year business. You know, it's not like they're starving for money and do that. And by the way, just so you know, in order to trying to buy off the city with this proposal, they're offering the city of Albany $1 a ton for the municipal solid waste that they take in.
Right.
The city's opposed to it. I just so you know, I've been told that already by the mayor.
Okay.
And they're allowed to take in 749 tons a day altogether.
been Dominic Casolaro, and we've been talking about the waste management transfer station proposal down on the south end. I believe actually 100 Boat Street, if you want to look it up. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. So the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network will certainly be following up on the situation in the south end and with this new proposed transfer waste station. We're also going to be covering, as you may have heard, the state gave $200 million for offshore wind towers to be built at the port. And according to the new climate law, 35% of that $200 million, or $70 million, supposed to go to benefit directly to people in the neighborhood. So we'll see how that comes along.
And coming up soon is Earth Day. So there will be a protest about the relationship between the military and climate change on Earth Day. That's April 22nd at 11 a.m. at Hancock Air Force Base in Syracuse. Here, Mark Dunley talks with John Amidon of Veterans for Peace.
We're speaking today for our Peace Bucket with John Amidon of members of Veterans for Peace and the Upstate Drone Coalition. He's also co-editor with Marina Mon and Steve Brayman of Bending the Arc, Striving for Peace and Justice in the Age of Endless War. Now, John, you have another action planned for Hancock Field out there near Syracuse with the 17th attacking wing. You know, I know they operate a lot of drones out there. So why this upcoming action and when?
Yeah, Mark, thank you for having me. It's actually the 174th attack wing in Syracuse at the Hancock Airfield. Anyway, we're planning this action for Earth Day. Climate disruption has increased to the point, you know, we're really at a planetary crisis with climate migration. Are now a necessity for many people all around the world. Militarism is a large driving force of climate disruption. The U.S. military has over 800 bases worldwide. Imagine that. We probably have about 10 of them, at least in New York State, and probably more than that, actually. But and it has a huge carbon footprint. It's an enormous polluter, and we just have to address this problem.
So, you know, one of the things we say about foreign policy is the one issue where the Democrats and Republicans actually have more agreement than they have, say, on some of the domestic issues. But how has the Biden administration been so far in sort of the whole issue of militarism and particularly climate disruption?
Well, in terms of comparing him to the Trump presidency, clearly Mr. Biden is a great improvement and a breath of fresh air. But in terms of militarism and foreign policy and the military budget, he's dreadful as usual. He's actually proposing an increase to the Pentagon's budget this year. And what we need is, a minimum of a 50% reduction. But I don't want to put people out of work. I was thinking we should be transforming an organization that would work on climate restoration. And a lot of those people in the military actually do really care about the country. So put them to good work, put them to something that's life affirming and useful. And then we can really make some progress by taking that money from the military and destruction and war and putting it to climate restoration.
Now, the issue of the military and the climate is a pretty big issue. We did do an interview just recently with Pat from Trout Rock Center, Pat Hines. And actually on April 25th, I'm doing for an Eco Action Committee of the Green Party of the United States, a 4 p.m. Seminar with David Swanson and Madeline Hoppins, a peace activist from New Jersey. But where else can people go to get more information about militarism and the climate crisis?
Thanks for asking, Mark. This is truly an important question. And one of the sources I'm using is the National Priorities Project. And they put out an excellent report titled No Warming, No War, How Militarism Fuels the Climate Crisis and Vice Versa. This, you can Google this report and pull it up. And it's about 42 pages, but it truly is well worth your time for understanding complex issues. But they put it straightforwardly and directly, and it's fairly easy reading. Anyway, I highly recommend it. The name of the report again is No Warming, No War: How Militarism Fuels the Climate Crisis and Vice Versa.
Can you give us some, you know, examples, illustration about how folks, you know, might wrap their minds around how the military is fueling the climate crisis?
Yeah, and you mentioned a key word there, Mark, fueling. The military runs on fossil fuels, and U.S. wars presently are mainly for oil. And then, of course, there's the corporate end of it to sell weapons. But an interesting illustration is a B-52 Stratocruiser in 1 hour uses as much fuel as an average car driver in 7 years. And the U.S. military produced 59 million metric tons of greenhouse gases. And you know, that's such a huge number, it really doesn't compute. But according to the EPA, what one metric ton of greenhouse gases is produced by driving from San Francisco to Atlanta in an average car. So that's one metric ton. And annually, when this report was done, 59 million metric tons of greenhouse gases were being produced by the military. It's the largest institutionalized user of petroleum.
So can you talk a little bit about the concept of a green military? And I would assume, of course, that the two major parties argue, hey, you know, yeah, we spend a lot of money, but national security is really important. That's what we have our military for.
Yeah, these are important questions too, Mark. And how best can we achieve national security? Well, it's obvious, taking care of human needs, and we better start here and now. We have, you know, an immigration crisis at the border, children along the Texas border coming up from Guatemala and other Central American countries. And Guatemala was recently hit by two hurricanes. So this is climate migration in part. And rather than helping, we now have a militarized border and a wall, which is really useless to everyone. And this is likely how U.S. citizens are going to be treated when we have internal climate migration, and that is coming too.
You know, I would also throw in, you know, Syria as a recent example of mass migration due to climate. Obviously, the civil society in Syria had a lot of problems, but when the historic drought occurred and forced so many people off the land into the cities, that was just sort of the match that ignited the firestorm. But you raise this idea that you know, Americans may be seeing more of these internal walls put up. Like you look at all the wildfires taking place on the West Coast in California. You know, but that seems a bit of a stretch to, you know, many of our listeners.
Yeah, I can understand that, Mark, but have you ever heard of the bum blockade?
Actually, I haven't.
You haven't? Okay. Well, the bum blockade was during the Dust Bowl of the 1930s when there was the drought and dust storms, and they were ravaging the Great Plains. And so people headed out to California. And the Los Angeles Police Department positioned officers along the border with Arizona, and they called it creating a bum blockade. So they wanted to ward off the Dust Bowl migrants. And these kinds of border patrols resemble what we're doing now with today with law enforcement and militarization of our police departments. And it's happened in other places too. Colorado declared martial law along its southern border to repel people as aliens, and Florida institutionalized at one point a poverty quarantine that sought to keep people out who had little money. So this is a cautionary tale. It's happened already internally in our country. The Southwest, NASA keeps telling us.
Well, John, we only have about a minute left, so I want to give you an opportunity. This vigil is Hancock Field, Thursday, April 22nd at 11 a.m. You know, what about arrests? What about social distance? And close us down.
All right. Excellent questions. No arrests are planned. We want everyone to be safe. The pandemic is a very real threat, so masks will be required. We will social distance. And we have a number of large colorful banners, and we're going to bring the climate front and center and how the military is disrupting it and destroying it. And I mean, that's the quick close down. We've spent $6.4 trillion on the war on terror since 2001. How much more are we going to waste? We could have transferred the whole energy grid to renewable with far less amounts than that.
Well, John Amidon, among other things, a member of Veterans for Peace, Upstate Drone Coalition. Thank you for being on Earth Day, April 27th, 11 a.m. April 22nd, 11 a.m. at Hancock Field, Syracuse, New York. Go to upstatedroneaction.org for more information. This is Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. And I will remark that Earth Day, last year really been set up. 50th anniversary was going to be really big, and we sort of lost it during COVID. Hopefully we'll be more focused to it this year. And Biden is holding an Earth Day climate summit, so there should be a lot of attention next Thursday around that.
Great. And then for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming to you from the beautiful sanctuary for independent media in Troy, New York.
And to learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Okay, next up, our labor correspondent, Willie Terry, spoke to labor organizer Saladin Muhammad on the Southern Workers Assembly and Black Workers for Justice. Here they discussed the theoretical outlook of Black workers in the South struggling for the right to unionize.
One other thing I want to know is what were some of the tactics that Amazon deployed to try to prevent the workers from unionizing?
You had the surveillance, that's on the one hand. Workers gathering together, the surveillance was able to detect that, you know, they were required to tap in some kind of app on their phones that monitored them, etc. That's one thing. They had the typical captive audience meetings, but they pasted anti-union stuff throughout the plant in the bathroom stalls, all of these kinds of places.
You know? This was Amazon, and, right?
Yes, Amazon did that. You know, and this was very, very intimidating. You know, because on the one hand, it says that the employer can break the law. I mean, really, you know, putting that stuff up like that, I think, is in violation of some sections of the National Labor Relations Act. But they disregarded that. You know, they got billions of dollars, and they're prepared to pay a little Weasley fine, you know, a couple thousand dollars. But they want to show that they have unlimited power over the workers. And this affects the workers. It especially affects the workers when they're trying to organize a campaign at one location in a big global corporation at a time. It just overwhelms this campaign that they're fighting this behemoth, this doggone great giant, great power. And
I also heard that they used to call the workers to meetings, and they used to, like, in a classroom and talk to them why it wasn't good to have a union?
Oh, yeah, yes. That's those captive audience meetings, you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it looked like they just called them in a space, whether it was a classroom or not, but they got such a big location. And if anybody appeared to challenge it or appeared to ask the question that may sound like it's disagreeing with management or the management's union buster, then they'll be approached after the meeting almost like, well, what did you mean by that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of this gets back to the workers.
Now, what was the percentage of, let's say, black workers to white workers in that?
Said it was between 80% and 85% black. Wow. Yeah, 85% black. Mm-hmm. Again, the reports that are coming out now, if one looked at some of those reports that that the union initially filed a petition based on a bargaining unit of 1,500, and then they had to then adjust their position to deal with the bargaining unit of 5,800. One has to question the kind of investigation that the union had done in terms of the workforce and that kind of thing. That's a big error. Right there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about, that union too. What was the name of the union that started organizing those Amazon workers and in their fight? And how would you rate their effort?
Well, it was the retail, wholesale, and department store union, RWDSU. Mm-hmm. It's an industrial union. I think it had its origins in smaller workplaces, pharmacies, and became connected to 1199.
Right.
I think that some of the typical mistakes that's made by many of the national unions of trying to organize one shop at a time and not having a kind of a rank and file effort in several other shops in the same corporation. I think that was an error. This company is the second largest company in the world, second to Walmart, second largest company. And it's vast, over a million employees. The strategy to organize in this kind of corporation, the strategic preparation, planning. It seems to me that it requires more than a 3 or 4 month period where you file a petition and then you organize around a vote.
Mm-hmm. But why did they pick that particular Amazon to start this campaign?
Well, the workers came to the RWDSU. RWDSU in Alabama and probably closer to Bessemer, they have about 6,000 union members, at several poultry plants there. So that was the union that was approached, probably because it was in the same state and probably because it was in the same proximity, probably because some of the relatives of the workers at Bessemer also worked in some of these poultry industries, So I think that could have been a reason why they approached them. And, too often, unfortunately, because of some of the weaknesses and the competition in the trade unions, some unions will get into a situation quickly because they may not want, you understand, these workers to go to another union if they were dissatisfied.
Right, I got you.
Sometimes you have that quick response that kind of way.
Okay. Let me ask you this here too. Now there are Amazon plants all over the country here. Is there any plant, is there any Amazon plant in the world that's been unionized?
No, well, yeah, around March, I think it was March the 22nd, you know, the Amazon workers in Italy, I think it was, they went out on strike. Probably about 30,000 workers, I think, went out on strike, or maybe a one-day strike. And, you know, they unionized again for around time issues, the pace of work issues, and wages, those kinds of issues. So, yeah, there are some unionized Amazon workers in the global economy, but none in the U.S.
None in the U.S., right. So there is a unionized Amazon worker in Italy?
Yes.
Right. Oh, okay. Is it in other parts of Europe?
I think so. I'm not sure, exactly what countries, uh-huh. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, was this the only time that a union attempted to organize Amazon in the U.S., or were there other times that they did and lost the union?
Yeah, I think it was in Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
There was a campaign in Delaware that was unsuccessful. It wasn't a huge campaign. There are networks of forces now organizing, not unionizing at this point, but building internal organizing committees and networks in Amazon, in terms of them connecting up so that there can really be a social movement, you know, fighting for policy changes until they are strong enough to begin to launch, you know, union campaigns, you know, in multi locations.
Mm-hmm.
They exist. They develop more of this network as a result of the Bessemer campaign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really important to look at the Bessemer campaign through the lens building a movement to organize labor in the South. Mm-hmm. Or else, I think you understand, we measure the impact or the climate, you understand, created solely through whether it wins or loses a union vote. You know, this campaign lifted up solidarity all around the country and in other parts of the world.
Right.
But it also triggered the consciousness of many Amazon workers. For example, in North Carolina, as we were leafleting in solidarity with the Amazon workers, I mean, the Bessemer workers, we collected contact information from over 100 Amazon workers. This contact information, look, I want you to contact me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to look at those gains as well in terms of how this campaign has helped to position forces to make a wider and deeper run the next time.
So that was part two of Willie Terry's interview with labor organizer Saladin Mohammed of the Southern Worker Assembly and Black Workers for Justice, particularly about the organizing campaign with the Amazon warehouse workers in Alabama. You can go to mediasanctuary.org to catch all three of the segments.
Next up, Heather Bruegel is the Director of Cultural Affairs for the Stockbridge Muncie community. She recently spoke with producer Melissa Bromley about bringing an indigenous perspective to the upcoming Sustainable Futures Conference.
My name is Heather Bruegel, and I'm the Director of Cultural Affairs for the Stockbridge Muncie community.
And can you tell, for folks who are listening who might not have heard of the Stockbridge Muncie community, a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Stockbridge Muncie community, also known as Mohican Nation, are the original inhabitants of the Mahicanatuck River Valley, which is in New York, along with the Berkshires and Massachusetts, parts of Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. We are the original inhabitants of that area that you now live on, and those are that's our home. And in 1609, our first encounter with colonization actually came when Henry Hudson came sailing down the Mahicanatuck, and we were like, hey, what are you doing here? And life changed forever in 1609, and through various different removals, you know, we ended up here in Wisconsin on land that was created by the Treaty of 1856. And this is where our seat of government now lies. And we are a federally recognized sovereign nation. And yeah, that's kind of like in a nutshell.
So we're talking right now. I'm in Troy and you're in Wisconsin.
Yes.
And but you, a lot of your work is focused on this area because it is where you come from.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's our homelands. That's where, you know, our ancestors were. That's where my ancestors were. And so a lot of our work does focus out there.
There's a Sustainable Futures conference coming up and you have been asked to speak there. Can you tell us a little bit about what you will be speaking about?
Yeah, I'm really excited. So the conference organizers reached out to me and I was very excited to jump on board. And what I will actually be, I will be doing two things. One, I will be opening the conference with a land acknowledgement. And then the second thing is on, I believe, Friday of that conference, I am going to be doing a workshop on land acknowledgements and how you can create them and why they are important and why we need them. And so, yeah, I'm really excited to be part of that.
For somebody who's listening who's never heard of a land acknowledgement, can you tell us what they are?
Yeah, a land acknowledgement is really just what it sounds like. It's a phrase or a paragraph or what have you that acknowledges the land that you're on. And when we talk about acknowledging the land that you're on, no matter where you're standing, you are on Indigenous land. So what you're doing in that acknowledgement is you are honoring the land and the people who were there before you. So before colonization, before settlement, before all of that, and then taking that acknowledgement and putting it into practice with, you know, action steps and, you know, things that you can do to continuously acknowledge. So it's not just words on paper, that it's more of a living, breathing kind of acknowledgement. So, yeah, they are actually quite popular. They've become quite popular over the past few years. And I think, you know, during this pandemic, people have, you know, really stopped to think and are like, you know, whose land am I on? And we get requests all the time for land acknowledgements. And so this is, you know, just a little thing that I put together last year when I was at a conference, a virtual conference. And it's just a way to help people acknowledge, you know, the history of that land, because you're life on that land it's not insignificant, but it's small compared to the history of that land. And so there's a bigger history behind that we want you to look at. And so that is what a land acknowledgement is. And that's what I'll be talking about. I'm really excited.
Thank you for that. And it occurred to me as you were speaking that is directly related to the content of this conference, because in acknowledging the land and what it was like pre-colonization, it's impossible to not acknowledge the fact that the colonizers have made this land toxic. Is that something that you will speak about at this conference?
I think I'll probably bring that into the workshop, you know, itself, to talk about that this land is important. In, you know, Indigenous communities, we always talk about the seven generations, and it's our jobs. Like, we don't own the land. We don't in many Indigenous languages, there isn't actually a word for owning land. Like, that's just not a thing, because we're caretakers of it. We're stewards. We're here to protect it for the next seven generations. Mm-hmm. And so that's really important. The land is living and it's breathing and it's constantly changing. And, you know, it's our jobs to protect it. And so I think, you know, when I'm talking at the conference, I will bring that perspective into it, because it is a sustainable conference. And so I want to make sure that we are getting that Indigenous perspective on caring for the earth while also learning how to acknowledge the people who were there beforehand.
What would you like to see in the Capital Region's ecological future?
You know, more emphasis on protecting the land and not so much on building buildings because you want to, or creating infrastructure that's not needed. Let's focus on the grass and the trees and the wildlife and the water that we have going on right now. Let's protect them. I think we can all agree that there's now, I know progress is always something people want to, you know, continuously do, but you can have progress and it doesn't have to be based on pipelines or mining or, you know, cutting down trees and building buildings. Progress can be also measured in cleaning the water, protecting the earth, protecting the wildlife and things like that. So I think that would be awesome. You know, if a densely populated area like the Capital Region could focus on that, that would be huge across the board.
Are there any specific areas in this region that come to mind when you think about protecting?
Yeah, absolutely. We, with the help from the sanctuary and other agencies, we were able to bring awareness to a natural gas pipeline that was going to go through one of our culturally significant areas, which was Papaskini Island. And it's an area that is culturally significant to Mohican Nation because it was where one of our sachems or leader, Papaskini, resided. And of course, this pipeline wanted to go through the undeveloped part of this island. And, you know, we continuously pushed back and, you know, reached out to other organizations to help us. And we were able to, they halted progress for now. They didn't say they're actually scrapping the plan, but it's not happening anytime soon. And so that is always important. And we want to protect areas like that. Papaskini is nominated for the National Registry as a historic place. And we, you know, are currently working to bring it to not just nominated, but actually be on the Federal Registry for Historic Places. So that is, you know, that's important to us because there's different steps you have to hit in order to be nominated. And one of them is, does this area look like it did way back when? So if Papaskini were alive today, would he recognize this area? And it was deemed, yes, he would. And so we want to leave it that way. We want to make sure that, you know, his home is protected because that's part of Mohican Nation history. And so things like that are very important to us.
Is there anything specific that you'd like to see this conference be a building block for?
I would like to see more alliances built between Indigenous and non-Indigenous groups coming together and realizing the importance of clean air, clean water, clean land, protecting fish and wildlife. I think the more alliances we can build across the board, I think the better. We're more powerful when we work together. We saw, even though it did end with a pipeline being built, but we saw what the power of people can do at Standing Rock. We're seeing what is happening now with Line 5 and Line 3 protests in Minnesota and in Michigan. The power of people coming together, I would love to see that happen at the end of this conference.
We just have a minute left. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you think people should know?
You know, just the importance of working together, understanding that, you know, when Indigenous nations are coming together to fight for clean land, clean water, we're not doing it just on behalf of us. We're doing it on behalf of everyone who likes to drink clean water, who likes to breathe clean air. That's everyone. And so we, you know, it's, people seem to look at it, oh, it's an Indigenous issue, it's a Native issue. It's not, it's an all of us issue. And at the end of the day, the earth is going to be fine. We're the ones who are going to suffer. So let's work together. Let's build those alliances and understand that, you know, an Indigenous cause is an everybody cause. Hopefully that just sense of togetherness comes out of this conference.
Where can people go to learn more about the Stockbridge Muncie community?
Oh, you can visit our website at www.mohican.com. You can also follow our cultural affairs department, where we do a lot of this work, on social media. Our Facebook page is the Arvid E. Miller Library Museum and Cultural Affairs Department. We post everything that we're doing in our department. We do our virtual programming up there. And you can also find links to donate to any of our programs up there as well.
Thanks, Heather.
So that was Melissa Bromley speaking with Heather Briegel. She'll be heading the breakout section in More Than a Land Acknowledgement, as part of the Sustainable Futures Conference, which will take place April 27th, the 30th. For more information, www.sustainablefutureconference.com.
And finally this evening, Kaylin McPherson talks with John Mahoney, the owner of Snowman's, about how his small local business ice cream shop is surviving in a pandemic. He also talks to a few of their customers.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Today I'm talking with John Murphy. He's the owner of Snowman's. He'll tell us a little bit about the history of Snowman's and what it's like to run a small business during the time of COVID. John, can you tell me the brief history and what you do at Snowman's?
Well, I've owned it for the last 23 years. Make all the ice cream here on premises every morning. Start my day about 5:30 in the morning. Make about 8 to 10 batches of ice cream a day. Clean the machines. Make all the soft serve flavors that we're going to run for the day. Just a fun thing to do. You know, being the owner, got 17 employees that I oversee. It's a true family business. My wife's involved, my kids involved, my mother's involved. I mean, there's a lot of us in the family that are involved. My niece works for me. So, I mean, it's a fun family business. Back in 1953, Tom Tully built the building here on the corner, 114th of Fifth Ave, started, I believe he opened on Mother's Day that year, maybe a limited menu, maybe 12, 14 flavors of ice cream he had, and he expanded it as the years. In 1977, Don Baker bought out Tom Tully, expanded to, I think, 25 flavors, 30 flavors, somewhere along those lines, which I continue to have today, 25, 30 flavors available between vegan, sherbets, ice creams, plus the soft serve flavors. I bought it from Don Baker in October 1998. We signed the contract. 99 was my first season. We expanded, I think, about 13 years ago to a mobile catering operation as well, doing big events in the Capital District, plus big corporate clients. COVID, that was all shut down last year as well as this year. We're still not doing, you know, any type of catering off premises. We are still doing catering packages, but people are coming and picking them up. For instance, today I got 375 dishes going out to RPI, but we're not going on premises. They're coming and picking everything up. So, you know, the whole industry's changed with catering and stuff like that on our end. We just got to keep everybody safe, but, you know, it's still a great business. The community supports us 100%. We give back to the community on a daily basis, supporting different events throughout the area too as well.
What are some challenges you are facing with the pandemic as being a small business?
Biggest challenge is all the restrictions in New York State. You know, different restaurants, not so much us. You know, we've had to space things out, 6 foot distance, so the lines go all the way down the street. You got to keep everybody safe. You know what I mean? But, you know, I feel bad for my restaurant friends who have restaurants who were at a 25 or 50% capacity through the winter months with no outside dining, obviously, because it's cold here in the Northeast. I worry about them. I mean, not so much myself. I worry about all the restaurants that had to suffer through this whole pandemic, you know, with the restrictions that were in place. Some of them are getting lifted now. I believe we're up to 75% capacity in indoor dining, but the summer season's coming. So hopefully a lot of these restaurants can get back on their feet right now. As far as us, I mean, we had to do a curbside pickup service last year, shut our windows, you know, just to keep everybody safe. And that worked, but we were only doing 40% of our daily gross sales. And I couldn't survive on that, you know. Just thank God, you know, I had enough resources, you know, to keep things afloat while my employees stayed on the payroll, got paid. But, you know, a lot of people just don't have those resources and you feel bad for them. We just got to support takeout, all these restaurants. My family's continued to support them, my whole family. And I just hope the public continues to support them to keep these little mom and pops around.
Definitely. Definitely. That I thought, why is it called Snowman's? Like, I'm interested in why it's called Snowman's. Do you know?
Tom Tully started it years ago. It was called Tully the Snowman. And that's a name that he came up with. It's passed down through the other two owners and myself. I'm incorporated as the Snowman. Don Baker was incorporated as, I believe, Tully the Snowman. Along the lines, though, I mean, the Tully family is what made this business. The name was given from the Tully family. It didn't have anything to do with Don Baker or me. He's not around, obviously, to ask him that question. I just don't know where that name came from. All the paperwork I got when I bought the business, you know, I never searched through it to see where the name came from, but it was a great concept for a name.
Definitely.
And it stood since 1953. It's an icon. The sign is an icon. When you look at the sign, it just signifies in your head the snowman.
As a small business, what positive has come out of COVID?
I think it's brought the community closer together. That's my opinion, as far as people are really noticing the restaurants and supporting the restaurants. You know, you talk to different people. I'm going out three nights a week now to do takeout. Maybe we're not going to the restaurant, but we're ordering from different restaurants. Where before you might've ordered once a week, you know, but these people are really helping restaurants try to survive. I think it's brought the community closer and made the community more aware. That, you know, there is a need to support small family businesses.
Definitely. Definitely. And why do you think people keep coming out to Snowman's?
Hopefully it's for the great product that we serve. You know, we got great customer service, our staff, a lot of them been with us a long time. I just, you know, I make all the product in the morning. I rely on my employees to get it out the window with a smile. Although you can't see the smile because we all got masks on, but just great customer service and great product. And, you know, it's a meeting place. You know, people come down here, they stand in line. They talk to different people, you know, it's just, let's meet at the Snowman, go get ice cream, you know, and it's a community place. And I'm glad to support the community because they support me.
Where can people find you either come into your restaurant or even online?
We have a platform, social media platform. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're on Snapchat. I don't control that. I have other people that take care of that end of it, but you know, online, thesnowmanicecream.com. Our whole menu is listed there. You know, we want it updated daily for only frozen yogurt flavors, our different soft serve flavors of the week. If we're out of a flavor because we're switching and making another flavor, you'll notice that on our hard whips, you know, on our hard ice cream page as well. But everything to do with the business can be found right there on our website, thesnowmanicecream.com.
Anything I didn't ask you that you'd like to add today?
I think you covered everything. I think you're pretty good.
Thank you to John Murphy for taking time out of his day to talk with me for this interview. He's the owner of Snowman's. I went down to Snowman's to get some ice cream and to interview some customers on their thoughts on this local business.
Because I live in Troy and it's local. Yes, and I like to support local businesses.
What do you like about the ice cream?
It's delicious. Everything they have is great.
I support it, and I have since I was younger, because they have really great ice cream, and the people here are just really nice.
Cool, cool. What's your favorite flavor?
I like creamsicle, orange creamsicle.
That's cool. Cool. Thank you.
Good ice cream, good business, keeping social distancing alive, I guess.
What flavor are you going to get today?
So I was planning on getting just like the chocolate chip ice cream sandwich, and then I was getting a little doggy bowl for my dog.
I've been coming here for years. Good customer service, good prices, good location, good ice cream.
What's your favorite flavor?
I'm boring, vanilla.
I don't know. It's my first time here. I'm excited to try out the flavors.
What flavor do you think you're going to try?
I don't know. I'm in such a long line that I have to wait to see what the menu is.
All right, thank you. Piqued your curiosity to come out today and support this local business.
We're around the corner in the area.
Ah, cool. What flavor are you going to try today?
I'm just a vanilla guy.
What about you?
Vanilla.
Cool, cool. Thank you.
If you'd like to go to the Snowman's Ice Cream, they're at 531 Fifth Avenue in Troy, or online at thesnowmansicecream.com. This has been the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Kalen reporting. Stay safe.
Well, I have to say black raspberry is my favorite ice cream. That was Kalen McPherson talking with John Mahoney about Snowman's institution up there in Landsberg. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Our engineer is Sina. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
The Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thanks for tuning in.